This program was brought to you by the Academy Opus Caseus, whose training programs bring cheese professionals to the next level.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Greg Blaze. We're recording live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I'm lucky enough to have one of my good cheesy friends and a nomad of Gandalfian proportions, Jason Hines from the Neal's Yard Dairy with me today. How you doing, Jason?
I couldn't be finer, Greg.
It's nice to have you and thanks for coming on.
Pleasure.
You know, I know you traveled thousands of miles solely to be here.
Absolutely.
In this booth with me. So thanks so much. So we've been doing this great little series called Lost Cheeses, or something that we just decided to explore. Things come and go, and cheeses are one of those things. And I would know that you and I, throughout the years of doing business together, we've both found and lost a lot of products. But specifically, I wanted to tap into your knowledge of your own market and the Neal's Yard Dairy and its missions. And I believe that one of its greatest missions, and the thing that I've been able to see it do for a long time, is find cheese that has been lost, but to also try to keep things from becoming lost. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that if you chart the history of the business, and we've been in business now for 36 years, but in the earlier phases of our business, the British cheese landscape was really very bleak, and this was before my time. But you know, a lot of the work of Randolph, who's the main owner of the business, and who was working back then, he was crawling around in his Peugeot, in his little Citroen, Diane, knocking on farm doors, looking for in cheeses that were very much endangered. I mean, take for example Mrs. Kirkham, for example. She makes a Lancashire cheese,
and that's very much what I wanted to talk to you about, that particular type of cheese, and use it maybe as a little window to talk about how and why things get lost. Lancashire is one of the most traditional of English cheeses, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think we have a history of making hard cheese. They're known as the territorials, we call them, because they come from different territories, and those territories give the cheese its name. Cheshire is one, Lancashire is another, Cheddar another, and Double Gloucester and Stilton are the main ones, Caerphilly too. And, at the time that Randolph started in the business about 30 years ago, most of these were either endangered or they were extinct.
What's the main reason why cheeses become endangered or go extinct, in your opinion and experience?
Well, the 20th century was a brutal century for cheese making. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the 19th to the 20th centuries, as far as the territorial cheeses were concerned, there were thousands of cheesemakers making those cheeses. So Cheshire particularly was the one that was the most widely made. There would have been probably somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 farms making Cheshire cheese, albeit on a very small scale. But nonetheless, those are the sorts of numbers the number of farms that were producing. So you think about the diversity that comes with that. It's difficult to imagine it now because we don't have anything like that. Lancashire, there'd probably been about 700 or 800 farms making. So altogether, of all the territorials, let's imagine there's probably in excess of 5,000 farms making territorial cheeses. So by the time we get to the early 1980s, when Randolph started knocking on farm doors looking for traditionally made territorial cheese, there was probably four Cheshire makers, one Lancashire maker. And by the time I started in the early 90s, there was only one Cheshire maker and one Lancashire maker, two Cheddar makers.
That's a lot of attrition.
It's pretty serious. To answer your question, how did that come about? Why was that? I think there was various phenomena in the 20th century that caused this serious decline. Obviously, there's the no small matter of two world wars.
Of course.
The First World War, millions of people died in that war. A lot of them would have been people who had expertise in farming and or cheese making. So obviously, there's natural attrition, death.
War will do that.
War will. But also the period between the First World War and the Second World War, you begin to start to see real momentum gathering with larger scale cheese manufacture.
Industrialization of food making.
Exactly. So, and a lot of that industrialization, as far as cheese making was concerned, was imported from this country or from Canada or indeed from Australasia. At the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries, cheddar cheese that was imported from, you know, the colonies, you know, the Australasia or from the US or Canada, was cheaper to buy than cheddar that was made in England. You know, so a perverse reality.
That's what happens when the empire gets that large, my friend.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So the mass production, the creameries that popped up, that had a terrible effect on farmhouse production, needless to say. And then right on the heels of the 1930s, you have the Second World War. And that was really catastrophic because the cheeses that were made, the territorial cheeses that were made, there was a lot of caps on what kind of cheese you could make because we were rationed. So during the course of the war, there was a government mandate which dictated what type of cheese you could make because you had to make cheese that could be preserved for longer periods of time.
Yeah, in cans and tins and things like that.
Well, it wasn't in cans and tins. It was just cheeses that could be kept for like 6 months and more. So there was a cheese that the government issued, which was a kind of cheddar, but more like a Colby recipe.
Okay.
So the sort of 6 month type age of cheese. So Stilton, for example, all the Stilton producers did not make any Stilton throughout the Second World War. They were all obligated to make this harder type cheese because Stilton was a short shelf life cheese, wasn't pressed. So it was obviously, it was fragile and not easy to keep. So all the Stilton makers had to make that type of cheese during the war. Caerphilly makers would have had to make that type of cheese during the war too. At that point, some of these traditions were just lost because a lot of people who would have made a tradition, a cheese that for generations they'd made before, switched out, had to make that, and either didn't go back to the cheese they made before when rationing finally finished. And rationing didn't actually, the war finished in 1945. Rationing didn't finish till the time the Queen was crowned in 1952. That's a long time.
Yeah,
so you're talking about between 1939 and 1952, rationing is going on. So the country is poor, people need to be fed, food needs to be preserved.
And that's, for me, that's insane because cheese is one of the most preservation-minded and survival-minded foods that we make. You know, taking the essential building blocks of life, milk being one of them, putting them aside for later use, to provide us with nutrients and sustenance.
Exactly.
So you squeeze that cloth a little tighter and then... Five Lancashire makers, you said, maybe 10 become how many? One or two?
I think at the beginning of the 20th century, you'd probably got 700, 800, something like that.
Yeah.
But by the time you got out the other end of the Second World War, you're talking about, you can count those on the fingers of, three or four hands. So, 20, 30 producers. By the time you get to the early 1980s, there's one.
Kirkham's.
And in fact, there's another in between the Second World War and us meeting Kirkham's that in the early 80s, there would be another very significant factor on the diminishing of the farmhouse cheese making community, and that would be the arrival of supermarkets.
Of course.
So supermarkets are looking for cheap. They're looking for standard. They're not looking for variation of quality. When we met Kirkham's in the early 80s, there was also a commodity pricing structure. So if you were making in a large factory, there's a big factory in Longridge, which is about 5 miles from where Kirkham's make their cheese, the little village where Kirkham's make their cheese. The price that Mrs. Kirkham was being paid for her cheese, although she was only making a few wheels a day, was the same price, £1.20 a pound, as the large factory up the road that might have been cranking out a few tons.
Yeah, you just get lost in the shuffle there.
you just can't compete.
Now, just so our listeners are aware, Lancashire is a cheese that's made traditionally two ways, in the creamy Lancashire and the tasty Lancashire, correct? One being the younger, the second tasty being the more matured.
Yeah.
And those were sort of co-opted by a third type that came about in the 50s and 60s, post-rationing, which is called crumbly Lancashire. And that's the one that you're talking about, which is made in a non-traditional way, correct? Now, Lancashire is made in using the surplus milks of any number of milkings, sometimes one, two, four, six, correct, in the traditional way.
Yeah.
And so what that crumbly Lancashire producer, those massive producers did was take that recipe and the need to use up the excess milk, of which there probably was a lot less after all those farms went away. All of those people went off to war. Some of them didn't make it back.
Yeah.
And the ones that did came back to a vastly changed agricultural landscape. Made it from necessity in rebuilding the agricultural landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Just got lost in the shuffle. Mm-hmm. Then you've got this one gal, Mrs. Kirkhams, who gets found by Randolph Hodgson, your guy. And they're competing with these monolithic, you know, milk slurping and dishing out, you know, machines of industry.
Yeah,
correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just to talk for a second about the type of cheese that Mrs. Kirkham's making, because that style. She does indeed make, as you suggested, with the curd of more than one day's milking.
Yes.
That came about for the same reason that, you know, the Conte manufacturers made, when Conte manufacturers made a single wheel, it was a large wheel of cheese. Lancashire was a large wheel of cheese, usually a 40-pound block. In order to gather enough curd together, you sometimes wouldn't have enough curd from the milk of one day, because you might only have one or two house cows.
Certainly.
And you'd build up until you had enough curd in your mold, and then you'd bind the cheese, just as in Conte, the milk producers combined their milk so that they could make one whole cheese. So that style of cheese is very, you know, quite labor intensive. Now, of course, Mrs. Kirkham now makes, well, it's her son who makes the cheese, 17, 18 wheels a day, but they still maintain that tradition because it just makes a more tasty cheese. Whereas all these factories up the road, they call it traditional, but they're making with the milk from one day. It's not a mixed curd cheese. So Randolph, seeing this cheese, blown away by it, because the interesting thing also was at that time the tradition of butter binding the cheese.
Can you explain to us what that is?
So the cheeses are bound in a muslin cloth.
Yeah.
But the traditional way of treating that cloth was to then heat up some butter till it was molten, and then rub that around the outside of the cloth to kind of seal the cloth, bind the cloth to the cheese. And Mrs. Kirkham still does this to this day. But in those days, because the supermarkets she sold her cheese to, insisted that she put wax around it, because that's what everybody else was doing, all the factories were doing. So at that point, the Kirkhams were really on their uppers. It looked like they probably would go out of business. They were tenant farmers, and they were really, really struggling. Randolph bought some of these cheeses, took them to the counter, put them on the counter. Our customers responded to them very favorably. And he went back to her and said, listen, if you could you just take that wax off? His instinct was that the wax wasn't good for the cheese. It was not letting moisture out.
It's the whole idea of wax, right?
I mean,
it's to trap whatever's inside.
Exactly.
In there.
And those kinds of cheese, you know, that cheese does not like it. That cheese has got moisture to lose. You can get some quite sour flavors. You can get some quite unpleasant flavors if that moisture is locked in.
Yeah, it's like a bunch of dirty laundry piled on top of one another in a sealed off, waxed in hamper.
That wasn't the analogy that I would have used, but
sorry.
That's fine. He persuaded her to take the wax off and said at the same time, if you do that, I'll give you an extra premium of 50p a pound. Well,
yeah.
If you're being paid £1.20, 50p is a lot more money
Hell
than you're
yeah.
being paid. And so naturally, she agreed to do that, and sort of 25 years later on, the Kirkhams now own their own farm. Mrs. Kirkham is now happily retired, takes fairly frequent coach trip holidays to Scotland with her son John, and owns a little BMW.
Oh, that's fantastic!
It's a story with a happy ending, yeah. But it could so easily have been a very, very bad ending.
Well, that's great, and thanks for sharing that particular story of Lancashire with us. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about the mission of Neil's Yard Dairy and what we can do to try and prevent things like what happened to the Kirkhams or what almost happened to them in the future. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
And this one's called Communication by Fote. We'll be right back on Cutting the Curd.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm here with Jason Hines of the Neil's Yard Dairy, who was just talking to us about just really, really interesting and insightful things about why cheeses get lost through the lens of one of my favorite products that I had ever purchased from the Neil's Yard Dairy, the Kirkhams Lancashire, and something that's still pretty rare to this day. You don't always get them, but they're around, and they've been saved in no small part due to the efforts of you and your guys specifically saving that cheese.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about in the second part of our show. Things do get lost, and I mean, it's insane to think that on a podcast about cheese, we'd talk about the Second World War and the First World War and how those events bound together. They caused agriculture. I mean, it's so simple when you think about it, that how humans treat each other and treat the land, but it's something that's rarely talked about as a reason why things get lost, at least on my little installment of this podcast.
But
as you say, that's a story. The Kirkham story is one with a happy ending. So I was wondering if you could give us a little insight, because when we spoke to Sue Connolly of the
Cowgirl Creamery,
and it was a great little interview we did on drought in California and cottage cheese, and how that cheese used a lot of water, and how it had to go away for a little while, but now it's coming back. And I was wondering if you could give us a little insight on how everybody, or how producers in the UK or anywhere in Europe, how they can prevent things from being lost, and what you guys at Neil's Yard Dairy are doing to set up systems to make sure they aren't.
Well, I think that at the moment we're in a phase where there's much less danger of cheeses being lost, because there's a much greater awareness amongst a growing community of cheesemongers, as well as a young and growing community of cheesemakers, that this kind of quality of cheese is that has a future. People want that quality, and that there's a price that's appropriate for that, which people are willing to pay and should pay.
How sustainable is that for long term? I mean, is that just self-perpetuating, or we hope?
I think it's got a lot. I think there's a lot more. There's not enough distance between the commodity versions of cheese and the versions that are sold. So, for example, you've commodity cheddar and you've got Montgomery's cheddar. The difference between those two is nowhere near as big as it should be when you consider that Montgomery's is a Grand Cru, the block cheddar up the road is a Vin de Village. If it was a wine, there might be a multiple of somewhere between 5 and 10 between their prices. With cheese, it might not even be a multiple of 2.
It's so slim.
Yeah.
But they're being called the same thing.
So the other analogy, which I think is even more potent, because I think the wine world is a little bit can be seen to be elitist, and it's not a food stuff. But if I think I've been thinking a lot lately about Spain. I've been visiting Spain a lot, and I find it the most dynamic food selling country that I've visited, because there's no fear of price in that market, of either from the consumers or from the people who sell food. And I think if you look at what the makeup of what they eat in Spain, one of the things they eat, everywhere you go, Serrano ham dominates.
Sure.
And there is no fear of price, because People were willing to pay €200 a kilo for a Serrano that's high quality acorn fed black pig type Serrano, or something which is an entry level, and all the strata of quality that lie in between. So without that fear, there's no fear because there's an understanding that you can have a sort of one product which is a ham, which is worth 10 or 15 times what another one is. People get that. With cheese, we don't have that understanding. So to answer your question, I think there's a long way we can go yet. But it's just creating the understanding amongst cheesemongers and cheese consumers alike that this value is genuine, and that they feel comfortable with that value. Don't fear it. If you take the fear away, then I think there's a lot more scope to grow, to give the premium that cheesemakers need in order to be encouraged, or more people to be encouraged to go into cheese making and cheese selling.
Yeah, and it's an education thing. You fear what you don't know.
Yeah.
So if you start at the beginning with
exactly.
The cheesemakers and educating the cheesemongers and the people like you guys in between both of those things, educating everybody involved, then that knowledge bleeds down into the customer base, and they understand that even though something's being called the same thing, it's of vastly different quality, and they pay for the quality. And that perpetuates,
So I think there's a lot of mileage in it. So I think it's very sustainable. I was one of your podcasts that I listened to. I think it was Matt was talking with another cheesemaker from New Jersey, and you were talking about that was a very interesting podcast. And in that one, you were talking about price and cheese pricing and what the future looked like. And I'm not sure how positive everyone felt about the future. I feel very positive about it.
Tell us why.
Well, because for the reasons that I just gave, which are that
you see it in other markets that works the same thing.
And I think if you take the fear away and you give people confidence that a premium product should deserve a premium price, and everyone feels good about that. Look what David Gremmels has done with the Rogue River. That's an amazing that's a testament to the fact that. If the cheese is really well made and tastes delicious, it's got a price that is appropriate to be paid for that. And he feels great about that cheese, and so he should. And because he feels good about it, other people feel good about paying for that. And I think that's right. And that's a model which I think people should look at and think, right, we'll feel good about making it. If we make it good, then we can charge the price for it.
I agree with that. And I'm asking you those questions, but as a retailer, I do that as well. You got to stand behind it. What you charge, the prices you put it out there, you have to be behind and sell the things in that way.
Yeah.
And you sort of you just encourage people to buy what it is and not what it costs.
Exactly.
And that's the best way to go.
Yeah.
For me, and I mean, the answer to all these things, we just have to keep selling cheese, really.
And we have to sell it on the front foot. So there's a when you stand in front of a consumer, when you stand in front of a customer, and that initial engagement happens, there's an instant where you look at the cheese that they're interested in. There's an instant where you have the fear or you have no fear. You step forward, you step back. If you step back,
it's
like an animal interaction.
Yeah,
they'll
completely.
Smell the fear. They'll smell the fear that you have.
It's true.
If they
though.
Don't smell fear and you step forward, they'll be comforted and the transaction will happen. But it happens in a split second, you strike or they strike.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you got to put the zap on them right there.
Yeah.
There's no way they're going to walk away without it.
And if the cheese is good, they'll come back and buy it again.
They completely will.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
will. And I know that for a fact because I've seen it so many times. And I love that. I think that sometimes I personally get caught up in looking at a very large picture and sometimes forget that on the level that I'm allowed to work at, selling, as you said, on the front foot is the way to do it. You just keep on grinding it out, customer at a time. You see them come back. And
It's a long game.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's a game that I've been playing for a long time, and I see it working both in this market in the UK as well. I think it's very sustainable. I think it's sustainable because we have a lot of in our country. I'm not sure what it's like here. I think it's maybe slightly similar, but the price of milk is very, very low.
Sure. Dangerous for dairy farmers.
Currently in England, it's about 10 cents below the cost of production, which is injurious.
That's not good math.
It's ridiculous. There's a neighbouring farm to one of our cheese producers who's got a very large herd, 1,000 head and is losing something close to $20,000 a week.
You can't stay in business like that.
Not for many weeks, no. So, you know, but having said that, what's happening now is we're in a climate where we're short of cheese. That's to say that, you know, there's a greater demand amongst our customers for the cheese than we've got ability to supply. It's a great situation, but not one that's also sustainable in the long run. We have to find that cheese.
No, because the time catches up to you eventually there. If they're long on milk but you can't sell it and make any money on it, you're going to be really short on cheese and it's going to get shorter.
But what's good is that we have dairy farmers who are approaching us regularly now who are so desperate because they can't sell their milk at the price that they need, that they want to add value to it. So the future is bright, I think. So hopefully in the next 10 years, we'll see more people going into cheese making, whether they're making traditional British cheeses like Lancashire or Cheshire, cheddar and so on, or indeed a lot of these new traditions that are evolving, which are inspired by more continental style recipes or perversions of English recipes.
So that rising tide will kind of float all the boats.
That is what is beginning to happen.
That's fantastic. I love that. Yeah. I wanted to say, you know, you said you'd listen to one of my podcasts. I really appreciate that.
Yeah,
I know you're a busy man.
There's a lot of people in our business listen to the podcast and find them very, very inspiring.
Yeah, we got some great email from a Londoner, Neil Robinson, who had some comments. I just wanted to say hi to all your guys out there at the Neil's Dairy and all the people in the UK who listen to us. It makes us feel really, really good. And you know, we try to spread the word. Sometimes we have very serious topics like this. Sometimes we joke and goof around. But, you know, needless to say, I always like to have you on because that's your opinions are facts to me. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been under your spell for years. I listen to everything you say. But I mean, it's like it's great that you have that positive outlook and you can articulate it like that.
Yeah.
And I know there are a lot of young cheesemakers and a lot of young cheesemongers as well. We just saw in the CMI. You know, I felt so old there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, me too.
I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, people are now half my age. But I hope that they perpetuate what we've got going on, you know?
Yeah.
And they can link up with groups like the Neil's Yard Dairy and really dig into the history of the dairy and see that the great work that you've done with English cheesemakers, you know? And you guys finding new cheese out there too? Are you finding new old cheese, should I say? New things were lost?
The cheeses that we lost so many, there was only a handful left to find, and we found them. What's heartening is that there are, you know, when I started selling cheese in the early 90s, there was only two traditional cheddars left. Cheddar's the most consumed cheese on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And the most popular cheese in England, and yet there's only two farms making the true variety, a true farmhouse cheddar variety. Since that time, you know, their numbers have increased by 50%.
Fantastic.
We've added one more.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, that's a step in the right direction. So I think that probably by the end of this decade, I imagine that we will probably be up to, there's one more that we're looking at that might be making cheddar, you know, by the end of the decade. And the reality is that these traditions that were nearly extinct, while they're still close to extinction, those businesses that are left are now secure. And are running short of cheese, and that is inspiring others to think about going into that type of cheese production.
Sure, so that's like a turning of the tide a little bit.
It does feel like that. Yeah.
You can see it. You can see it happening.
Yeah.
Like you said, that's one piece of cheese at a time for us mongers down, you know, at the end user stage before we send it out there to the people in the world to consume. That's all fantastic. You know, Jason, I just want to thank you very much for coming in today. I know you rushed over here to get here. We're going to send a police escort to get you across Brooklyn.
Sorry, I was late.
really quick. No way. You're never late. You always arrive right when you mean to. It's good stuff. Well, thanks so much to everybody for listening. And stay tuned next week for another edition of Cutting the Curd. And we'll talk more about cheese. Ciao.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.